Welcome to Beyond the Spin. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Every week, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the issues that are important to our communities during the 2012 election season. We'll be going beyond the headlines, beyond the horse race, and beyond the spin to get to the heart of the issues that have the most impact on all of our lives. We will be bringing together community journalists in a national conversation on the air, linking the stories and voices of diverse communities around the United States. As public radio journalists, we seek to bring the interest and opinions of communities that are often left out of the national broadcast landscape to the airwaves. We are building this new show as a dialogue, a conversation between communities about the future of our nation, with people from all parts of the country sharing their unique perspectives. There are plenty of other places to hear the pundits from inside the D.C. Beltway, but Beyond the Spin will feature voices from all the diverse communities that make up our country. This week, we're going to cover a mix of topics as we speak with guests from around the country to hear about the most important issues in each of their communities. Later this hour, we'll hear about a hotly contested congressional race in one of the largest congressional districts in the country on the border between Texas and Mexico. And we'll discuss what it means for everyone throughout the country. We'll also head north to Minneapolis, home to both the largest urban Native American population and the largest Somali immigrant population in the United States, to hear about the key issues there and the political shift as Minnesota has become increasingly conservative politically in recent years. But first, I spoke with two journalists for their take on what's missing from the national presidential campaign discussions. My guests are Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call Radio at KALW in San Francisco, and Shed Johnson, news director at WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama. Here's their conversation. I'd like to ask you both about the issues that you think are not being addressed in this election for your communities. Rose, let me start with you. And then we can just get into a dialogue back and forth about it. We saw the Democratic Convention clearly appealing to Latino voters and talking a great deal about some of the social issues around gay marriage and women's rights and more. And so it was very emotional, and it clearly locked in a lot of their supporters and clearly locked in a lead for President Barack Obama in this election. But I'm curious what you both think is missing and what conversations are taking place where you live, Rose.
Well, for me, what's missing is the reality that we're facing with jobs, because the economy is at the top of the list. And I heard over and over at the convention that we are creating jobs, right? But what everyone is failing to mention is that the majority of the jobs that are being created are low-wage jobs. The Employment Law Center just came out with a new study that found 3 million of the new jobs that have been created pay between $7.50 and $12.50 an hour with no benefits. And frankly, I think this is the elephant in the room. Because of NAFTA and outsourcing, so many factors have contributed to this. But where we are right now is that there is no possible way you can feed your family, pay your rent, and send your kid to college on a low-wage job. But this is the future. The other thing that we're not talking about is the fact that a lot of these jobs are temp jobs. So because there's so much demand for jobs, the employer knows that they're in control. They've got the power. So people are so desperate, they'll take whatever they can get. And they're hiring people on a temporary basis, which means you as an employer have no power. The other thing that is the elephant in the room is the decimation of unions. Because this is happening, workers do not have any collective bargaining power, which means that they cannot stand up to their employer and say, $7.50 an hour with no benefits is not going to do it. In fact, I interviewed a guy at a Walmart warehouse down in the L.A. area, the largest port in the country. He is making $8.50 an hour. He works from midnight until 8 in the morning. And he is responsible for moving 250 boxes from the container that comes off the ship to a pallet that goes across the country. He makes $8.50 an hour. He sometimes has no access to clean water. This is in the United States, no access to clean water. Because he spoke out, he was followed to the bathroom. His hours have been cut. He was not able to pay his rent, so he now lives in a motel. And Walmart workers in that area are starting a march to the L.A. area on Thursday. It's a 5-day march to raise awareness about what they're facing.
Hmm.
So nobody's talking about this. And if we're going to talk about jobs, we really have to talk about what kind of jobs that are being created.
And probably nobody's, I bet you major media is not even covering that that march.
No, they're not.
And Shed, from your perspective, then I want to kind of pull back and hear what both of you are saying and marry kind of what you both are talking about in the conversation
here. Yeah.
Go ahead, Shed. What about for you and the folks in Montgomery, Alabama?
Well, I think one of the things, and to sort of echo what Rose was talking about, I noticed that that the political discourse these days is to just leave the disadvantaged and the poor out of the discussion altogether. The new catchword now is middle class this, middle class that. And I was struck by some numbers, Mark, that came over the Associated Press wire just before we began our conversation. The Census Bureau reports the number of Americans in poverty stood at 15% in 2011. 15%. That's 46.2 million people, or nearly one in six, are in poverty. And I just noticed that looking at the GOP platform, the Democratic platform, there was very little mention of the continuing, or if there ever had been, the war on poverty.
So let's leap into this for a minute. I mean, I think that we're talking about 15%, and of course that's 15% of the people of America by the poverty definition of the federal government, which was created during the Lyndon Baines Johnson administration.
Yes.
In the 60s, when we were talking about rent, food and not rent. So in many ways, people could argue, Shed, that it's a lot larger than that because that definition of poverty doesn't quite fit the 21st century.
It does not, because I'm ashamed that I didn't look up the dollar figure that the federal government has classified for an individual who is considered impoverished. And I think the figure is like, if my memory serves me correctly, $11,000-$12,000 a year, something around there. It might be even a little lower than that. But I was just struck by the absence of conversation dealing with this and. When I saw these numbers come up and listening to what Rose said about the low-paying, the high number of low-paying jobs that people are forced to take these days, that sort of number just sort of stood out at me. And I just wonder why it all of a sudden has just been pushed on the back burner. I think in a lot of ways, when I think about how the Mitt Romney campaign has sort of framed the welfare quote-unquote welfare argument about the federal government, or rather the Obama administration now is throwing out certain rules that a person can just sit back and just collect checks and not bother to try to seek employment. And it almost as though the word poor has become a dirty word.
Right. Well, and it's been this way for years. I mean, you'll remember that in the 2008 election, the word poverty wasn't mentioned one time. You didn't hear it from Obama, and you didn't hear it from McCain.
Yes.
And I don't think it's going to change much this time. I mean, if you watch even the cable shows, the pundits use the same language: middle class, middle class, middle class. But nobody's asking, what does the middle class mean? I mean, I think in many ways the middle class is really the new poor because of these low wage jobs. And when you look at, for example, at the Republican National Convention, you had 14,000 reporters, okay? You would think that maybe a couple of them would write about the fact that Tampa, Florida, that area, has one of the highest poverty rates in the country. And the only story I could find about this was CBS. So CBS deserves kudos because they wrote about it. But, you know, if I were a reporter that went to Tampa, I would leave the convention because I couldn't handle the speeches, but I would leave the convention and go to, like, a food bank, go to a shelter, and just say, you know, what are you seeing? What has changed in the last couple of years? And what I'm finding is you've got places like Albuquerque, New Mexico. There's a shelter called Joy Junction. It's the largest shelter in the area. Recently, they had to start turning men away because there's so much demand from women and families. I mean, here in San Francisco, we've got they cannot keep up with demand. I mean, when you're talking about a growing economy, you know what's growing are the food banks. they're expanding and they're hiring because the demand is so high. And they can't, the politicians cannot ignore this for much longer, because you can't expect a huge segment of the population who cannot afford basic necessities to eventually not take to the streets. I think that's what's coming.
Well, and that's unfortunate, Rosa, because, you know, one of the things I've noticed that is that if you are, shall we say, down on your luck, if I may use that term, you're perceived as lazy, as someone who doesn't have the wherewithal to pull up your bootstraps and just go out and make something happen. And I think that has been lost. And I think the poverty issue that we've been discussing with our national colleagues, it's not the flavor of the month, if you will.
Exactly. And also, when you're talking about corporate media,
yes,
they like to appeal to people who buy the products that they advertise. And if you're poor, well, you're not buying much, so why should we talk about them?
Exactly.
But I think you bring up a really good point, and about the poverty being, the poor being lazy. I mean, this is such an old, go back to Reagan, right, with the welfare queens. What's really interesting about this is that I just did a story about older homeless women, and I spent a lot of time at shelters early in the morning, because in San Francisco, in order to get a bed, you have to be in line by about 4 or 5 in the morning.
Right.
And when I went to the shelter, I saw a number of men in line that looked kind of like history professors. I mean, not the stereotype, but they didn't look like the, quote, typical poor. And so I approached these guys and I said, you know, what are you doing here? And this one guy said, you know, I just was fired from my job as a manager at a high-end restaurant making 50 grand a year. What's happening is these people are being fired and new college grads are being hired at about half the salary with no benefits because they're so desperate. This guy is now sleeping in a shelter because he overstayed his welcome at friends and family. And I said, you know, what has this been like for you? And he said, before I experienced this, I, like so many people, thought the poor were lazy, get up and get a job. And he said, now that I'm sleeping next to them, I realize that it is definitely not black and white. He said, I have so much more sympathy. I never knew how hard it was or realized how easy it was to drop into poverty.
So I wonder then, for both of you, a bunch of different questions here came to my mind as I was listening to the two of you. What do you think that in terms of being community broadcasters, of people who have a job to do to represent our communities and bring the stories out for people to wrestle with, what do we have to do in all this? I mean, what is our role? What should we be doing, and what are you all doing?
Well, from Alabama's angle, Mark, next week we have an interesting election. We have a proposal to add something to basically take money out of our state and oil and trust gas fund, oil and gas trust fund. I may have misworded that, but anyway, they're calling for people to vote next Tuesday on this proposed constitutional amendment that would take a little bit more than $400 million out of this oil and gas trust fund and put into Alabama's general fund budget, which funds nursing homes, hospitals, basically a lot of services that go to the disadvantaged, to poor people, if you will. Mm-hmm. And this vote has gotten very little attention. Mind you, now we have a Republican majority in our legislature, and because of these acute fiscal issues that are coming up, supposedly if this amendment doesn't pass, Alabama will have to release a lot of state prisoners and cut back on Medicaid and food related programs for the poor and the elderly and that sort of thing. And the striking thing about it is that you know, as of course as a public broadcasting entity, it's our job to constantly try to talk this vote up, you know, not swaying one way or the other, just let people know the facts. But I've noticed that the very politicians, Republican legislators who proposed this, have their silence has been almost deafening.
Rose?
Well, what we're doing is obviously giving people a voice and talking to people who are poor or who can't find jobs or are struggling. I think that's really important. And also, we check in regularly with the food banks and with the shelters to find out the changes they're seeing. But the larger issues are really continuing to focus on how we got here and to make the connections between the decimation of unions, trade policies, outsourcing, flat wages, talk about the fact that minimum wage has been static, and to also talk about Wall Street. Because frankly, what happened to Wall Street? It's almost like that conversation has gone away. Foreclosures are continuing. Inequality is growing. The bonuses continue. Nobody has been held accountable for this economic crisis. And I think that the bigger picture here is that the media tend to focus on these things like they're isolated cases. And they tend not to, they rarely connect the dots. I mean, there's a reason why we are here. A lot of people have a lot of money right now. We've got a lot of money in this country. We keep saying we're broke, and that is not true. There is a lot of money, but it's being funneled to the 1%, and the rest of the country is really suffering. So it's so important to step back and not sort of say, well, you know, that food bank is doing bad, but oh, look, there's a success story over there. She did pull herself up by her bootstraps. That's what the media tend to do. And it's really important for us to keep our eye on the bigger picture and make sure to connect the dots and still talk about Wall Street and this economic crisis.
Well, I think also, Rose, you bring up a very good point there. When you use the statement corporate media, you look at people like say an NBC or an ABC, and in essence, those are corporations which have multiple interests in multiple sectors of the economy. And I just think that in a lot of ways, they're deliberately issues like you just spoke of are just pushed to the side.
Exactly. Especially Wall Street. It's almost like it never happened and it doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly, yes.
So a couple of other things before we round out this conversation. I think it's really important all the things that both of you have raised here. I mean, first, just in terms of this election, I mean, as I've mentioned before in other conversations with you and with others, is that this Sussex University poll of the 90 million people who will not be voting this election, the unlikely voters, both registered and unregistered. Of both of those categories of the unlikely voters, 43% said they would vote for Barack Obama if they chose to vote. 23% said they would consider voting for a third party, and only 14% said they would consider voting for Mitt Romney and the Republicans, which says a lot about what a huge number of Americans feel and think, who feel disenfranchised and completely outside the process. It also says to me that there's this disconnect between the reality that you two are talking about around poverty and what's really happening in our society that media is not talking about, and also the love that many people have in America on the Democratic and voting and non-voting side, that after hundreds of years of racism and oppression, there's a black family in the White House, and the sheer beauty of that for some people. And within that is a contradiction that is hard to kind of get to in this election, and sometimes hard to get to, and it makes it even harder to get to the issues. I wonder what you all think about that.
Well, I think, Mark, in a lot of ways, is that all of us, and I can include the three of us, we've bought into to the American ideal, that American dream, that no matter how far down you are, we're in America, and by George, it can change overnight. And we cling to that, just fiercely cling to that idea. And just, I think sometimes, issues that Rose and I have brought up are deliberately, people hear us, but still won't believe that that tomorrow a new day will dawn, if you will.
Rose?
Did you say 90 million people are not voting?
Yes, I said last time it was 80 million, this time it's 90.
Wow, that is a huge number.
Yes.
90 million. You know, I took a road trip about 5 years ago to the so-called red states, the conservative states. And every time I stayed in a motel, I always asked the women cleaning the room, because they're always women, if they're voting. And I never met one who votes. But these women knew so much about policy because the policy hits them first. I mean, the policies hit the poor first. They're on the receiving end of these policies. And I found that so interesting because coming from a place like San Francisco, you know, you think people are online, they're addicted to news. And these women said, you know, I don't have to go to CNN to know that I'm getting screwed. I feel it firsthand, right? And I just thought, I mean, it was so eye-opening for me. But I was amazed, and this never gets talked about, these people know so much about what's going on, but they don't vote because no one talks to them. They feel like the politicians are bought and sold, and they don't care about them. And it's just sad to see that because you almost want to say, but do you realize you've got such a powerful voice? But then at the same time, you can't say, well, why don't you vote for president? Because, frankly, they're going to keep getting screwed. And that's the sad reality that we're facing.
Yes. Well, I also think, Mark, that, you know, the more you try to engage young people about the political process, it's almost as though, and it just frustrates me to no end, that they just sort of, they'll nod their heads and say, okay, but actually they're really tuning you out. You just can't seem to get them to understand the importance of them participating in the electoral process, to go to the voting booth and cast their ballot. It was just like Rose says, they just sort of feel that no matter, you know, if they cast their vote or not, it'll make no difference because the policymakers are going to do what they want to do.
Well, I think that I'm curious what the two of you will be thinking about in the coming weeks and what you're going to be focusing on. I think, Shed, that what you talked about a moment ago, the vote coming up in Alabama, which is a vote coming up before November 6th, correct? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. They sandwiched this thing between municipal elections, which were at the end of August. All the cities and counties in Alabama had mayoral and city council elections, and they put this constitutional referendum in the middle of September, which is next Tuesday, September 18th. The argument there is that they decided to put it there where it's not. Overshadowed by any other issues, but the argument
means it can get lost between elections and nobody comes out to vote.
Exactly.
And Rose, what will you be focusing on here in the next couple of weeks?
Oh goodness, we're so overloaded with information. Where do I even start? Well, you know what's interesting is I always think about my listeners, and they respond to the economic shows that we do. I mean, they want more shows about alternatives to capitalism. That's what they want, because our economy is based on growing and growing and growing. But what happens to our planet? The resources are not never-ending, and so that's what listeners want. And also, they really want us to go beyond the he said, he said. I feel so fortunate to work for a station that doesn't have us covering the horse race. We barely cover the conventions because, frankly, you know, what's the point? So we're gonna kind of do an alternative look at what's happening with the presidential race and the upcoming election. We're going to talk. We have so many important propositions in California, really important. Everything affecting everything from genetically modified food to the death penalty to raising taxes to fund our schools. So it's just, there's so much happening. And I think this is why independent media is so important. So we can go beyond the spin and really talk about what is important to people's everyday lives.
Well, this has been a really important segment. I really appreciate the time both of you have given to Beyond the Spin and to this effort here for community broadcasting. Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call Radio at KALW in San Francisco, and Shed Johnson, news director at WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama. It's great to have the two of you on. Look forward to doing this again soon.
Thank you, Mark.
Great meeting you, Chet.
Thank you all. I'm your host, Mark Steiner, and you're listening to Beyond the Spin. We'll be right back after the short break, so please don't go away. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Hello, this is Mark Steiner. Welcome back to Beyond the Spin. We're about to have a conversation with Tom Michael, who is general manager of Marfa Public Radio in Southwest Texas. He also hosts one of their programs from time to time called Talk at 10, looking at the business, cultural, and political life of their community. And Tom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hello, Mark. Good to be here.
Tom, first, tell for our listeners around the country who are all represent different parts of community radio. What is Marfa, and where are you?
We're in southwest Texas. Marfa, Texas is a rural community about 100 miles north of the Mexican border. It's a historically an old ranching community and has become somewhat of a tourist community. We also consider this area to be the backyard of Texas. We're near Big Bend National Park. It's high desert, beautiful big skies and big lands.
It's a great park. So but now the community that you in southwest Texas that listens to your broadcast, that a big part of it is in the 23rd Congressional District, is a really, at least in terms of the Mexican-American Latino vote and the white vote, is a very heterogeneous place.
It's a primarily Latino district. It's a huge district. It stretches all the way from San Antonio to almost El Paso. And, you know, to drive the district would be 6-7 hours to drive this district. It's a border district, probably one of the largest in the U.S. And it's been a swing district for many years. Over the past decade, it swung from Republican to Democratic and back.
What's that story? And why do you think that is? And I mean, I know there's been some issues in some of the previous campaigns around and the map of the district itself around the Voting Rights Act that was challenged. So what is the political story of the district?
Well, you hit on it there with the voting rights challenge. Late August, the Supreme Court came down with a ruling against Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, citing that Texas was in violation of that. Now, this won't affect November's election. The district is what it is today. And what I see in this district is an extremely gerrymandered district, primarily Latino. Again, it picks up an urban area, San Antonio, and then all of these rural districts, some of them that rely on energy, some of them that rely on ranching. There are some border communities like Presidio and Del Rio and others in this district. But San Antonio is the big elephant in the room. And the current incumbent is Congressman Kiko Canseco, and he is from San Antonio. His challenger, the Democratic challenger, is Pete Gallego, who is from West Texas, out in Alpine, Texas, a small town near us here.
So now tell me, what are the, you know, every place in this country is being affected by this election in very different ways. And what are the critical issues here that are affecting this election where you live?
Well, in a lot of ways, even though we are a rural border district, I mean, it does mirror, from the politicians at least, discussions on a national level. Kiko Canseco will talk about how we have burdensome taxes and regulations. Obamacare has really made our businesses struggle. We need a balanced budget amendment. His challenger, Gallego, will talk about we can't have all these cuts to Pell Grants. We can't continue to cut these programs. Access to rural health care is very important. So in a lot of ways, it does mirror the national conversation, despite the fact that we're a border community, despite the fact that we're both urban and rural.
So I'm curious why this district is kind of swung back and forth between Republican and Democrat. I know they're both major parties are vying for the Latino vote in America, and clearly the Democrats in the convention in Charlotte really put on a strong bid with different Latino stars in their party being brought up. So, man, why is this such a swing district, and how is all that affecting what's happening right now?
Sure. Well, a little bit of the history of it. This district was held by a Democrat throughout the 80s and early 90s, Albert Bustamante, who ran into some political troubles and some corruption troubles. He was defeated in 1992 by Henry Bonilla, a Republican. That was before the Gingrich Revolution, and he held that seat through to the early Bush years. Now, in a runoff election in 2006, Ciro Rodriguez, a Democrat, defeated Henry Bonilla, so it swung back to the Democrats. And then in 2010, a Tea Party freshman named Kiko Canseco defeated the incumbent Ciro Rodriguez in a very close election, again with some national kind of Tea Party support in 2010. So now we are here back in 2012. And as I saw in those elections, those swings, in a lot of ways they did mirror the national swings. You had the Gingrich Revolution of the early 90s. You had the Tea Party kind of revolution of the of 2010.
When I look at the candidates running, I mean, they really do represent both Democrat and Republicans' efforts to kind of bring the Latino vote to them. And Gallego, the Democratic candidate, appears, at least from his, he's in the state senate now, correct? Texas state
senate? Well, yeah. Here's the interesting thing about Pete Gallego. He lives in Alpine and also in Austin, which is the state capital. He was the state rep for the 74th district in Texas, another huge border district. He actually went as far as he could, some people thought, in state Democratic leadership in Texas. And as a leading Democrat in Texas, he, of course, worked with the GOP on many, many issues. And he saw this as the next logical step up. Kiko Canseco had a career as a lawyer and a banker, and again, he just entered politics. He's a freshman Republican. What's interesting thing about these two, they do represent a primary Latino population, and in fact, they will hold a Spanish language debate later this month, later September, that will be carried on television and also on radio, and the debate will be held in San Antonio. It'll focus on Social Security and on Medicare.
Well, what about issues of immigration? How is that playing out in this race?
Well, immigration is huge everywhere. In a lot of ways, it seems kind of counterintuitive to our local population that a lot of the energy in immigration comes from, you know, areas like Ohio or Kansas that seem pretty far from these immigration centers. San Antonio is a fast-growing city. I wouldn't say the same for rural West Texas, where I live. We're actually losing population net. Hmm. But we're surrounded by two fast-growing border cities, San Antonio and El Paso, and those kind of bookend this district. Another issue is that, as you saw in Tampa, U.S. Congressman Kiko Canseco was invited to speak. He's also in the past given the Spanish language rebuttal to President Obama's State of the Union address. So in a lot of ways, he is a leading Latino Republican, although a freshman, and he was put in the spotlight both in Tampa and in the past. I should also say that Julian Castro, the mayor of San Antonio, who was celebrated for his speech at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, mm-hmm. In a primary, had supported Gallego, had thrown his support to Gallego, even though his runoff challenger, Ciro Rodriguez, who came back to fight for the seat again, was from San Antonio. So it's, you know, people talk about the Latino bloc as sometimes being, a single bloc, and that's certainly not the case.
It's not a monolith. Everybody wants to make everybody's ethnic bloc into some kind of monolith that it's not, which is really true. But I wonder if how that breaks down in this election, with the majority of Latino voters in America voting Democratic, at least nationwide, and in the Mexican American community, is that the same in your area, or is something else afoot?
Well, it's interesting because of redistricting is always. There's always other elements in play. For example, this district does pick up some heavily Republican areas of San Antonio. And you understand that in San Antonio, just the numbers are so large. Right now, folks watching national polls say that this district is a toss-up and that the Republicans don't want to lose this congressional seat. We expect the money race to be really kicking up now for the next few months here. You would think that that is true, that Latinos as a majority vote Democratic, but this district is pretty well gerrymandered that it's listed as a toss-up.
Now, have you interviewed these candidates yourself, both of them?
Oh, yes.
So what?
Yes.
Give us your sense of the men, who they are, what they stand for, and how they're received by the public.
Right. Well, it's interesting. In the station that our radio station serves, we serve a blue county, we serve a red county, and we serve a bellwether county, a county that picks the winner. This district voted for Bush in 2004. This district voted for Obama in 2008. I don't know who does these maps, but these are pretty close statistics.
Uh-huh.
Pete Gallego, who's the Democratic challenger, the former state rep, has made education one of his primary platforms. When you talk to the incumbent, Congressman Kiko Canseco, he'll talk about, again, reflecting almost the national line, the burdensome taxes and regulations. He's a former banker. In conversations with me, he'll bring up the Dodd-Frank law quite a bit. He'll talk about Obamacare and big government. And he gave a big push to the balanced budget amendment, which really didn't go anywhere this past cycle, but he was out there talking about it quite a bit. So, you know, like I said, he got some great Tea Party support in these regions. This is an unusual region. Ron Paul polled high in some areas of this region. It's a very interesting Texas region, and I really think, as you said, it's not a monolith, this district. It's just so sprawling and so vast, and there are so many different concerns.
It's interesting, a question. I know not to break everything down just on ethnic lines, but when I read about your district, it's maybe 55% Mexican-American, but also it's got a very strong white American population, 40-some percent.
Correct.
Does that lean Republican? I mean, is that where the divide is, or is it more complex than that?
I think that's partially, yes, that's where the divide is. I would say those Republican areas of San Antonio tend to be more Anglo. The other big issue here is energy. This cuts across some energy-producing areas. Mm-hmm. And Kiko Canseco, the Republican incumbent, is seen as the champion of some old-line energy producers. And he looks at Gallego as a rabid environmentalist. And Gallego makes a point about clean energy and how Texas should lead in that as well. They Texans feel in a lot of ways that they invented energy with oil and gas, but that they could also take the lead in wind, which you see way up in the panhandle in other areas of Texas.
This has been fascinating, Tom. I really appreciate your time and giving us a window onto Southwest Texas in this election, a really interesting district. We look forward to getting back with you all to hear a lot more.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been fun.
It's been great. Tom Michael is general manager of Marfa Public Radio in Southwest Texas and helps to host the program Talk at 10 at their station. And take care, Tom. Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, you bet. Have a good day.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and another part of our conversation today on Beyond the Spin. We're traveling up to Minnesota, St. Paul, to KFAI, the community radio station there, to talk with Lydia Howell, who is host of Catalyst Politics and Culture at KFAI in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Lydia, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm real well. So you're a station that really appeals to a lot of different ethnic groups, a lot of different cultures inside of Minneapolis. So I'm curious, from that deep multicultural perspective, what is affecting people in Minneapolis the most in this election? What is not being covered that people are talking about?
Well, I think the foreclosure crisis has not been covered well, and the disproportionate impact that it's had here in Minneapolis, which I can speak to a little more than St. Paul, even though they're just across the river. The disproportionate impact of the foreclosure crisis, that's just sucked wealth from the African-American community as it has in many other places in the country. You know, of course, also employment is a challenge. And the fact that different communities are being impacted differently, the fact that long-time places, like we had a Ford plant here, that had been around since 1929, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and it just closed. Hmm. You know, the last Ford, you know, F-140 or whatever it was, truck rolled off the line. And, you know, you look at this beautiful plant, you know, it's just huge, acres and acres. And now it's closed and all those good middle-class jobs just vanished, you know, I mean, I think our situation here is probably easier than in some places. You know, it all depends on who you are. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, did that plant just close recently? How recent was that closing?
In this summer.
So
I guess it wasn't this summer. It's been like in the spring. There was talk and hope of it being the plant being used for something else. But you know, some kind of the popular term these days is public-private partnerships. But you didn't get the sense that the government really wanted to do that. They'd rather just sell it off to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But much of this acreage is overlooking the river, and so there's a party that thinks, are they just going to build some fancy, you know, totally unaffordable condominiums overlooking the river? You know, they're not going to really, you know, take this plant and do anything with it. It's hard to say. You know, it's hard to say what will happen, but it just seems to me that too often what happens is either it just rots or we get some kind of gentrified thing that 10% of the population could afford and the rest of us are out of luck.
So what is, let's talk about Minneapolis-St. Paul in terms of in terms of what the situation is with poverty, which is an issue that's not being, is one of the several issues that's not being talked about at all in this election by the two major parties, how it's affecting St. Paul, Minneapolis, and how it affects, you think, the election and the people there.
Well, you know, yeah, just like everywhere else, poverty, it's like a dirty word nobody wants to say. You know, like the unemployment rate, allegedly, for white people is about 5%, and for African Americans, it's 2 or 3 times that. I don't always trust these numbers because I figure they're only counting, you know, they can only count the people that they know for sure are searching for work. Minnesota's traditionally had a decent safety net. I'm originally from Texas where, you know, it's pretty much, you know, sink or swim on your own. Here, there's been a long tradition of a decent safety net, but that has been under fire for the last 15 years or so as the Republicans have made headway at the state legislature, and we just had Tim Pawlenty as our governor for a couple of terms. Now we have a Democrat, again, former Senator Mark Dayton. But there is still a safety net here. You know, I wonder at times how long that's going to be the case because of the political trends. But, you know, the part of the challenge is even when you have a safety net, what I see that here or anywhere in the United States, there's not any effort to get to help people gain the tools to get out of poverty. I mean, it's great if you've got, you know, you live in public housing or you have food stamps, if you have access to health care. Of course, those things are important, you know, the basis of life. I just don't see a willingness to invest in helping people gain real skills, be hooked up with real jobs. You know, if there are obstacles like child care or transportation to employment, helping with that, you know, mm-hmm. it's like a holding pattern for people. There's not much support in a sense, if you want to think about it this way, economic development of human beings. You know, the word economic development is used about countries, sometimes about neighborhoods. Well, how about for human beings? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, and you, it's interesting. Minnesota is an interesting state politically because you don't know whether people look at it from across the nation and they see Ralph Ellison and they see Michelle Bachmann.
Yeah, it's a schizophrenic reality. And one that sort of emerged in the last, I've been here since 1988,
mm-hmm.
and it's one that's really emerged since the 90s. I mean, any state in the country, if you go to rural areas, it's going to be more conservative. That's just how that is. But it wasn't such an absolute here because Minnesota has had an incredible history in terms of much of its immigration patterns of the late 19th, early 20th centuries, being from Scandinavian countries with a very progressive and sometimes even radical background. I mean, you still hear stories about the Finns who came here and settled in northern Minnesota where the mining is, and that they were socialists. Unlike Texas, which is a so-called right-to-work state and has always been very unfriendly to unions, Minnesota has a great labor tradition, but, I mean, just like everywhere, it's under attack. So But in the last, I'd say, 15 years or so, there has been a shift. My understanding is the Republican Party has really tried to invest some money in getting more Republicans and more further to the right Republicans in the State House and obviously elsewhere. You named the most known example, Michelle Bachmann. Though I would tell you, I've been to her part of her district, Minnesota. There are progressives, and there's even a tiny little peace movement of 25 people that every week have their vigil against the wars. So there are progressives all over. But, yeah, this is kind of becoming a purplish state.
So, again, what do we miss? What is the press miss? What does America miss about what's happening in Minneapolis, St. Paul? When it comes to political movements and what people are struggling and fighting about that we don't hear about? Because I know you live in a town that's, a really multi-ethnic town. It's, white, black, Native American, Hmong,
well,
Asian.
We've had a lot of, there's certainly been a huge influx in the last 10 to 12 years from Somalia. We have the largest Somali community in the United States. I think a lot of people would think of Minnesota as a white state, and we're not. It's become far more diverse in the time period that I've been here. And not much anti-immigrant sentiment, not like in a place like Arizona. There's been real attempts to integrate new arrivals into the fabric of the city with, I'd say, some reasonable success. And that's different. I think we're lucky. The employment picture here has so far been a little better. Things have been, remained maybe more stable here than elsewhere. But politically, I think that Minnesota's an interesting case because it is a place that had been very, had a long progressive history. Even Republicans were pretty progressive here until fairly recent times. But
right.
There's this political shift. There is a political shift.
And it's in Minneapolis, St. Paul itself is kind of the twin cities, as they're called. We were talking earlier about issues of poverty, how is that? When you think of urban America, especially with those of us here in Baltimore, talk to folks in Chicago. How does that image and fit feel for Minneapolis, St. Paul? There are a lot of issues there from people I've talked to, especially in Native and African American communities, of poverty and dislocation. I just wonder how that plays out politically.
Well, I think it plays out politically about the same way it does everywhere else, and that politicians don't want to talk about it. To some degree, Minneapolis, St. Paul continue to live on their laurels of past progressive policy. For example, one of the issues I've covered as a reporter since the late 90s is housing and homelessness issues. Consistently, the Twin Cities public housing is given national awards for being well-maintained and low crime, and that remains pretty true. But again, as in everywhere, there's this sort of beginning to undermine the whole idea of having a safety net here. I would project the possibility that the only way that you can really go after the unions, it's a 1-2 punch. If you really want to go after one of the last strong labor states, you got to kick out that. You got to get rid of the social safety net too, and it's got to be kind of a 1-2 punch. The communities of color here that are most deeply impacted, as you were alluding to, African American and Native American. To be blunt about it, they're not always particularly well organized politically. I don't know why that is. It's a question I've tried to figure out for a very long time. The Native American community can't say that it has shallow roots here because they've been here first for a long time. The African American community is smaller than a lot of urban centers and very transient. It's the long-time people are a small minority, and then there's a lot of people who've come from somewhere else in the last 40 years because they thought there would be good jobs there. And increasingly, there's been an exodus of people from Chicago to here. So you've got a lot of people who haven't been here very long. Myers-Briggs has been, those are very difficult communities to mobilize politically. It's saying something to make the observation that personally, I found the African-American community and the Latino community in Houston, which is where I lived the longest besides here, much more politically engaged and organized and active and present than African-American, Native American, or Latino people here. And I still don't quite understand why that is.
I mean, one of the stats I read about your city recently was that the one out of three children in Minneapolis live in poverty, and that's the federal standard of poverty.
Right.
And almost 7 out of 10 Indian children live in poverty.
Oh, yeah. Native American people, I think, are the most invisible people in this country. I mean, they don't even usually get mentioned. And Minneapolis has the distinction of having the largest urban Native American population in the country. Like I say, the communities do not seem especially organized. I mean, this is probably not a politically correct thing to say, but I'll say it anyway because it's one of the conclusions I've drawn after 15 to 20 years of living here, observing, reporting, and working as a community activist. These communities often seem that they are not organized. And certainly the power establishment doesn't want them to be organized. But often what happens is the most visible leaders seem to be practicing a kind of small-scale crony capitalism where, yes, they're in the media and they're getting grants and they're the leaders of this or that, or they're given a city job with access to jobs for friends and family. But the communities themselves are left hanging in the wind. And it's a troubling thing for me to even make this observation, but it's the conclusion I've drawn is that to a large degree, the communities are not organized and their so-called leaders have pretty much been opportunists. I hope that changes, but that's how I've come to, that's the conclusion I've drawn. Painfully, I might add, but that's what it appears to be.
Well, Lydia, this has been fascinating. I look forward to kind of checking back in with you in Minneapolis, St. Paul, KFAI as well. I want to thank you for all the time you've given us today.
Well, thank you, and I certainly look forward to following Beyond the Spin. I think it's a really important project, and I hope your listeners will go online and check out KFAI and my show, Catalyst. I think that we can continue this dialogue.
Absolutely.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
That's all we have time for this hour, and I'd like to thank all of our guests today. Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call Radio at KALW in San Francisco, Shed Johnson, news director at WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama, Tom Michael, general manager of Marfa Public Radio in Marfa, Texas, and Lydia Howell, host of Catalyst at KFAI in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'm your host, Mark Steiner, in Baltimore, Maryland, where I host The Mark Steiner Show at WEAA, a public radio station based at Morgan State University. And thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Spin. Please join us again next week. Beyond the Spin is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and WEAA, produced in association with the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. Our producer is Justin Levy. Our engineer at Center for Emerging Media is Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Please contact us with your thoughts and ideas, feedback, questions, or suggestions for Beyond the Spin at beyondthespin@gmail.com. or facebook.com/beyondthespin. Or go to steinershow.org and you can hear a podcast of today's show. And for Beyond the Spin, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com.